Okay, well, thank you. Thank you so much for having us over to talk about my favorite topic, biofortification. I don't know if I know anything about anything else. I hope the people, it's great that we can have so many people online. I hope the audio comes through okay. I'm going to divide my presentation into three parts. The first part, I'm going to motivate why it's important to that agriculture plays a role in solving the problem of malnutrition. That's the first part. Second part, we don't usually have cost effectiveness in the title, and so Keith and colleagues have done some new work on the overlap between fortification and biofortification. So I'm going to say more than I usually say about the cost effectiveness of biofortification. And then the third part will be the progress that we're making on Harvest Plus. And I'm aiming to be done, according to that clock, by 1:15. Okay, so I'll keep an eye on the time. So most of the people in the room that you've attended the seminar, you must already be aware of the huge problem of vitamin and mineral deficiencies in developing countries. You've been exposed to all the statistics. I'm going to talk about vitamin A, I'm going to talk about iron, I'm going to talk about zinc, because those are the three minerals and vitamins that Harvest Plus deals with. Every once in a while you hear a new statistic. I was at the fortification summit in Arusha, and I heard the statistic that 450,000 deaths are attributed to zinc deficiency every year. That was a statistic that I hadn't heard before. And it's an amazing statistic. But I'm not going to show you the maps of micronutrient deficiencies, etc. So what I want to do is I want to give some background on what's been going in agriculture. What I think is the underlying cause why we have so many vitamin and mineral deficiencies in developing countries. So this is the slide that I've been showing for a long time. This is changes between 1965 and 1999. This dotted line is 100%. This blue line, blue bar, is developing country population, right at 100%. So population doubled during that period. Back when our system, the CGIAR, was first getting started, people were worried about famines because of that population. They knew that population growth was coming. So we had the Green Revolution. We had high-yielding varieties of rice and wheat and maize. And the great part of the story was the production, especially in South Asia, was able to outstrip population growth. But what I wanna talk a lot about is rather dietary quality. And these bars represent pulse production. I'm not gonna talk specifically about pulses, but it's a holder for vegetables, fruits, pulses, animal products. Production increased of pulses and production increased by a quarter, but it didn't keep pace with population growth. Neither did vegetable production, neither did fruit production, neither did animal and fish production. So what happens to prices when you have that sort of a situation? These are prices for Bangladesh. I like to divide the diet into food staples, non-staple plant foods, fish and animal products. Non-staple plant foods can be dense in minerals and vitamins. Fish and animal products are also dense, and they're highly bioavailable. They're the best sources of minerals and vitamins in the diet. So I've indexed prices at the beginning when the modern varieties were first being introduced, and we all know that rice prices fell by 40% by the end of the 1990s. So it's a great thing for poor people because rice is their basic staple, for example, in Bangladesh. It's cheaper. But I want to draw your attention to the green and the red bars. You can see that prices doubled during that period because you didn't have the same productivity increases. So the problem for poor people is that dietary quality became more expensive. If your income didn't also grow, it was more difficult for you to afford vegetables and fruits and animal products. So that's the main theme of what I want to talk about. So these are some surveys that we did at IFPRI in the mid-1990s in Bangladesh. This is in the rural areas. So 80% of energy came from rice, and only 3% of energy came from fish and meat products. But if you use the same pie chart and you look at their food expenditures, you can see that already a quarter of their budget, their food budget, which is maybe 20% of their income, went for fish and animal products. So that's what people want to buy, that's what people want to spend their money on, because that's what they enjoy and that's what they need for good health and nutrition. But prices have been going up, and so even though they spent a fair amount of their budget here, it only represented a very small part of their diet, and so therefore their mineral and vitamin intakes are too low. So those were some price information from Bangladesh. These are some data from India. So again, you have the same situation where rice prices came way down. And then we had the price spikes in 2008, 2009. We all heard about rising food prices. It wasn't rising food prices, it was rising food staple food prices. Everybody talks about food security, and they mostly, it's what they're really thinking about is staple food security, energy security. So now rice prices, instead of being 40% lower, they're now around 20% lower, wheat prices. And in recent years, in the recent one or two or three last years, they've actually come down, and people aren't so worried about the high food prices anymore. But this is the data for India, what's been happening with the non-staple foods. And you can see we had the price series all the way out to 2010 here, and you can see that there's just been a general rise in the prices of those foods. So again, it's just getting more and more expensive over time because demand for those foods are high, the productivity increases just haven't been there. So we did a simulation analysis. We wanted to see what might happen to iron intakes due to food price increases. So this was the food expenditures that I showed you for Bangladesh earlier in the 1990s. So you've got about maybe a third of your expenditures on non-food. You've got the food staples, non-staple plant foods, fish and animal products. That's the proportion of your food expenditures. And we simulated a 50% increase in all food prices, like what happened in the 2008-2009 price spikes. So what did the poor do? When the rice price goes up, they have to keep eating the same amount of rice to keep from going hungry. That's their first priority. So they have to spend more on rice. So therefore, you have to spend less on these other things. So therefore, you spend less on dietary quality, and not only do you spend less, the prices are higher. So what this simulation showed for Bangladesh, there's already a lot of iron deficiency here in this previous situation. Iron intakes go down by 30% in the after situation. So when I hear about food price rises and food staple price rises, what I think about is that dietary quality is getting worse and worse. It isn't so much that people aren't buying about the same amount of rice. The problem is that their dietary quality is getting worse and worse and worse. So the price of vitamin A is going up over time. The price of iron is going up over time. The price of zinc is going up over time, and many other minerals and vitamins as well. So that's the background. Okay? So when we've been at this for many years, some of us trying to convince people in agriculture that they have an important role to play in solving the malnutrition problem. Back in the 1990s, when people discovered mineral and vitamin deficiencies, the nutrition community wanted to implement, and they are implementing, supplementation, fortification, other types of programs. They saw the gap. And they said, that's our role. And agriculture said, yeah, that is your role, not our role. Now it's a different situation today. There's a lot of people that recognize that agriculture has a role to play. We're not going to completely close the gap with agriculture. We still need fortification, supplementation, other types of nutrition interventions. But agriculture has to work with the nutrition community to solve the problem. And so that's the, to me, that's the background that motivates biofortification. This is, so those of you, you get in audiences where people in agriculture just aren't convinced that they really have an important role to play in nutrition. This is a picture taken from Bangladesh in the 1990s. Some researchers from Cornell University confirmed that this is rickets due to calcium deficiency. So there's an area in the southeastern part of Bangladesh where this rickets started appearing over a fairly wide area, and no one, it affected no one over the age of 20. It was younger people that it was affecting. So what happened was, with the introduction of the modern varieties, the change in the food system, something happened to the calcium supply in that area, and no one was, in some sense, no one was paying attention. And so this is what happens when you don't pay attention to how your agricultural policies are affecting, you know, your dietary quality, your mineral and your vitamin intakes. It's a very visceral image. So we know we have all the pieces of we have several pieces of the puzzle to solve the problem. We all want dietary diversity. That's the ultimate solution to the problem. It's going to take decades before the incomes of the poor rise enough to where they can eat the kinds of diets that we're all used to. So there are these other things that need to take up the slack in the meantime. And as I've said, there are lots of agriculture has an important role to play. And biofortification is just one piece of the puzzle. It's obviously not a silver bullet. It's just one piece, and I'll argue a cost-effective and sustainable piece of the puzzle. So first, a little bit before I get into the cost-effectiveness, what is biofortification? It's very simply this orange maize, for example, that's high in provitamin A. Africans eat white maize. They prefer white maize. The whiter, the better, in general. White maize has no vitamin A in it. Africans, vitamin A deficiency is a huge problem in Africa. If we can get African farmers and consumers to substitute one-for-one, growing the orange maize for the white maize, they're just as high yielding, they're just as productive, so they will sell for the same price. So the value proposition to the mothers is, which will you buy for the same price? Will you buy the one that has vitamin A, or will you continue buying the white maize? Will you buy the orange maize and protect your family from vitamin A deficiency, or will you continue growing and eating the white maize? It's just as simple as that. Now, Harvest Plus, all the crops that I'll talk about, the third part of my presentation is on the progress that we're making. All the crops breeding and releases that I'll talk about are using conventional crop breeding. So to develop these orange mazes, we started with some varieties that we found in Thailand that were orange. We did some high-level genetics. We found through marker-assisted selection certain genes that were important in raising the vitamin A content of the maize. But it's all conventional plant breeding, some of it very, very high-end plant breeding. You can use transgenic approaches. You've probably all heard about the golden rice. And that's also an important technique, but for reasons of not wanting to deal with the politics of GMOs, Harvest Plus has decided to just use conventional breeding. Not because we think transgenics are dangerous, just simply the politics are very difficult. So I'm, as Mira mentioned, I'm trained as an economist, and I've always been attracted by the potential cost effectiveness of biofortification. The basic idea is you can do the breeding. Agricultural research is very powerful, very cost effective. You can do the breeding in a central location. You have the basic varieties that are high yielding and high in nutrients. You can make that germplasm available to national agricultural research institutes all around the world. They get adapted to the growing system. They get in the food system, and you don't have recurring costs year after year after year. So the most of the costs are up front in doing the research to develop the varieties, but once they're out in the system, it's very sustainable, and the recurrent costs are very low, and that's at the heart of the cost effectiveness of biofortification. And I'll go into more detail. Before we start getting into some of the numbers, the Copenhagen Consensus is a group of economists that every few years rank different types of investments that can be made in developing countries. What are the most cost-effective? In 2008, they were asked to pick the 20 most cost-effective investments, and three out of the top five were related to reducing mineral and vitamin deficiencies. And at the time, our ex-ante benefit cost analyses were convincing enough that even though we hadn't really implemented biofortification at that point, they ranked biofortification as the fifth most productive investment that could be made. So there's a huge drag on economic development because of the minerals and vitamin deficiencies, so there's huge benefits to be had, and there are different ways of addressing the problem. So I won't go through those original ex-ante benefit cost analyses, but recently our team at Harvest Plus, including Keith, who's going to answer all the difficult technical questions that come up, they did a portfolio analysis. They looked at different types of interventions that could be made, and they looked at trade-offs and complementarities between biofortification and fortification. They looked at vitamin A interventions in Zambia. We have the pro-vitamin A maize that we're introducing in Zambia. They looked at zinc interventions in Bangladesh. We have a high zinc rice that we're introducing into Bangladesh. And they looked into iron interventions in the state of Rajasthan. And we have a high iron pearl millet that we're introducing in Rajasthan. It's a very detailed analysis. They're using an ex-ante simulation model, but the important thing is they have food expenditure surveys, ideas of what the food intakes are for urban populations, rural populations, farms, non-farms, different socioeconomic groups, and they've looked at all those groups, farmers versus non-farmers, et cetera, because we're looking for the niches of the different types of interventions. So obviously biofortification's niche is with the farming community. We start with the smallholder farmers who grow the biofortified crops, they eat them, and then they move into the marketing system, and then later on into the urban areas. Whereas the fortification, really, their strength starts in the urban areas, and then they reach into the rural areas. So this is a highly disaggregated model that they're using, and they're seeing how different groups are affected. And they've done the analysis in Zambia, Bangladesh, and Rajasthan. Another important thing is that they've used a 30-year time horizon. And as I'll explain with some of the following slides, biofortification in the first few years, biofortification is not cost effective. You spend a lot of money up front. When you first introduce the varieties, you're reaching a small number of people. And the cost effectiveness is only after a long period of time when you've been able to scale up and they're widely adopted and widely eaten. And that's where the long-term benefits come in. So we'll start with Zambia. There is currently implemented a sugar fortification. And there are various different types of fortification vehicles that are being proposed. There's Child Health Weeks which include vitamin A supplements. And the first thing they did was they looked at each intervention as a standalone intervention without looking at the trade-offs and complementarities. And the cutoff for whether an intervention is cost-effective is usually the cost is something like $200 per DALY saved, disability-adjusted life year saved. If you can spend less than $200 per disability life DALY, it's cost-effective. So they found that all of these interventions are cost-effective because they're below the $200 cutoff. The most cost-effective was putting retinol in vegetable oil, but the biofortified vitamin A maize, VAM, vitamin A maize, the estimated cost per DALY save was $24, so it's highly cost-effective. So now to look at the different combinations. Now this is way too complicated to understand this slide, but what they did was they took all different combinations. So you can take each individual, you can take two interventions together, you can take three interventions together, six interventions together, etc. You have a whole array of combinations that you can try. And these represent some of, you know, all the different combinations, not all of them, but many of the different combinations. And you can see that even the most expensive, it comes out, the average is $71 per DALY saved. So all of these are cost effective. So the base message is there's plenty of room, even if you implement several different types of vitamin A interventions. They all have their own niches. There's plenty of room to try to address the problem. Okay? Now it turns out that the most effective combination of two, and the most effective combination of three, and the most effective combination of four, and the most effective combination of five, all included biofortification, because it had a niche in the rural areas with the farmers that the other interventions did not have, or that biofortification had the most strongly. So I don't know how well you can see this, but this is comparing the reach of sugar fortification with the reach of the vitamin A, the biofortified maize. So what this shows here for the rural areas is that the sugar reached 48 plus 9, 57% of the population. The maize reached this percent of the population, I think it's 81% of the population in the rural areas. And this orange part, 35%, are the people that the maize biofortification reached that the sugar fortification did not reach. This 9% are the people that the sugar fortification reached that the biofortified maize did not reach. Between the two, 8% of the population was not reached by either one. Okay? So you can see that there's a huge chunk of the population that the biofortified maize reached. That, for example, the sugar didn't, nor the oil. You can make different slides comparing the two different things. And of course, that's for the rural areas. When you go to the urban areas, of course, this chunk for biofortified maize is going to be smaller. Okay, but it was still surprisingly high, 21%, because maize is overwhelmingly the food staple that the Zambians eat. Okay, I better watch my time a little bit. So when you go over the 30-year horizon, you can see that the DALY saved are more in the rural areas than they are in the urban areas, but still there's a substantial number of DALYs that can be saved by the biofortified maize in the urban areas. I think the simulations assumed that the biofortified maize was only accounting for 30% of the total production and consumption of maize in the country. So even though our reach was only 30%, it was still a highly cost-effective intervention. We'll move on to zinc in high zinc rice in Bangladesh. We estimated that it cost $79 per dally saved, and it was much more cost effective than the putting zinc in the fortifying zinc in the wheat flour. Okay, so in Zambia, the vegetable oil was the most cost effective, but biofortification was also not quite as good, but still cost effective. Here we found that the high zinc rice was the most cost effective intervention compared to the fortification. So it's going to vary by country depending on the nutrient, the country situation. So at baseline, 73% presently, or at baseline in the simulation, 73% of the population are zinc deficient in Bangladesh. They looked at how increases in income would improve the diet over a 30-year period. Yeah, income does improve diets, but it didn't eliminate zinc deficiency, didn't come anywhere close. But if you introduce the high zinc rice and it becomes widely adopted, you can reduce zinc deficiency to 26%. And adding the wheat flour fortification doesn't really affect the zinc prevalency. It's better probably to put iron in the wheat flour. We're not affecting iron through the high zinc rice. And then it's very important to note is, as I've mentioned already, the cost effectiveness depends on the level of adoption. If only 5% of people adopt the high zinc rice, it's not cost effective. But if 80% adopt the high zinc rice, it's highly cost effective. Okay? So that's something to keep in mind, and that's kind of the drama with biofortification now. We've done the breeding, we've done the nutrition studies. Can we get high levels of adoption? And if we can, we're home free. The other thing I wanna point out is something I mentioned in the beginning is the low recurrent cost. So in these simulations for Bangladesh, this is the cost of wheat flour fortification. So with fortification, with supplementation, you have the same recurrent cost year after year after year. The population is growing. You're having to fortify a larger and larger supply. So over time, the costs go up. But with biofortification, you have these initial costs with the agricultural research. But over time, your costs get lower and almost disappear. In this particular simulation, we put all of the harvest plus costs for developing high zinc rice, we loaded them into the Bangladesh simulation. So when we go to the calculations for India, we don't have any costs, right? Because we've already loaded them in the Bangladesh simulation. So I'm gonna skip over the rest of the slides on cost effectiveness because I'm supposed to finish in the next 5 minutes. And I want to talk a little bit about the progress that we've made now under Harvest Plus. So we pick certain target countries where we had our first releases. So the vitamin A sweet potato, which SIP worked on, our potato center worked on before Harvest Plus got started, but was part of Harvest Plus in the beginning. They already had varieties available in 2007. But our first varieties that we developed under Harvest Plus from the beginning when Harvest Plus started in 2003, we released our first vitamin A cassava in Nigeria at the end of 2011. So you can see that's an eight or nine-year process to do the breeding, get through the varietal release committees. We've also released varieties in DR Congo now. Our high iron beans were released in 2012 in Rwanda and then later in DR Congo. Our provitamin A maize was released in Zambia in 2012. So we've had 3 years of experience now. High iron pearl millet was released in India 2012. High zinc rice was released in Bangladesh 2013. They now have a release in India through the Indian universities in one of the states. High zinc wheat was sold as truthfully labeled seed last year in India, and will be released in Pakistan this year. I was just in Pakistan, and the variety's been released and will be planted for the first time in November now in Pakistan. So this is what's been happening in our target countries. Harvest Plus is committed now to raising the funding and doing what it takes to try to scale up the delivery of crops in these target countries. But we've been sharing the germplasm with national agricultural research institutes around the world. Biofortified crops are now released in 27 countries. I think actually Pakistan is now the 28th country. And we're in multi-location testing in an extra like 18 countries now. The pipelines are still, we have our initial releases in countries, but the pipelines are still, we have better varieties coming out in the future, even in our target countries with higher nutrient levels and hopefully higher yields as well. We've also invested in these other crops, but not as much as in the main crops in our in the previous slide. I've been going to China every year for the last 11 years, and we finally got the Chinese government to agree to invest in its own biofortification program that'll be part of their next 5-year plan. Brazil has its own biofortification program. They've had one now for 6 or 7 years. They're working on 11 different types of biofortified crops. Okay, I've reached my limit, but I have a few other things to go. So those are remarks that I should have made on this slide. So the green shows all the different countries where there have been releases or where the crops are in multi-location testing. So it gives you a sense of the global reach now of the biofortified crops. We have to do nutrition studies. We had to prove to the nutrition community that the biofortified crops could improve iron deficiency, vitamin A deficiency. We've done the studies on the iron crops. There's even been a meta-analysis of the different studies that was presented at Micronutrient Forum last year in Addis. The high provitamin A crops, we still have 2 efficacy trials in the field, but we have a lot of very positive evidence already on maize, on cassava, on sweet potato. So we're pretty much home on the vitamin A crops. We're not home yet on the high zinc crops. They were the last to be developed. We have bioavailability studies that show that the bioavailability is what we hoped for, what we expected. We have 3 efficacy trials ongoing in India. One of them has been completed. They're doing the data analysis, and we'll do a 4th trial in Bangladesh for the high zinc rice that will start next year. And so by the end of next year, we should have all the evidence in on the high zinc crops. We had an especially, just to give you a flavor of some of the results, pearl millet is high in iron anyway, and we have a higher iron pearl millet. And we took a group of children who were aged 12 to 6 and fed them the high iron pearl millet, and within 6 months, we resolved all the iron deficiency in the subjects in the intervention group. So that's been published and is there in the literature. A little bit on the dissemination of orange sweet potato. We did a pilot study in Uganda and Mozambique. We had intervention villages, we had control villages, we did baseline studies, we did follow-up studies. After 2 years, in the intervention villages, they switched to the orange sweet potato. They doubled their vitamin A intakes compared with the control villages. We measured an improvement in serum retinol in the intervention villages. And that's all been published. It's mentioned in the Lancet article on the special edition on nutrition. But that's not all. So a researcher from IFPRI went back to the Mozambique area 2 years. So we did that intervention for 2 years. We did the follow-up survey. He went back after 2 more years, so 4 years after the baseline study, 2 years after we quit doing anything in the area, and he measured the level of diarrhea in the intervention villages among preschool children compared with the intervention compared with the control. And he found that the incidence of diarrhea was 50% lower in the intervention villages, and the duration of the diarrhea was shorter in the intervention villages. So that just gives some feeling for the sustainability, why it's so cost effective, because we didn't do anything in the area for 2 years, but it was still there in the food system. People were getting more vitamin A, and the immune systems were benefited from the higher vitamin A intakes. I'm gonna skip a bunch of slides. I'm gonna make this the last slide. Okay, so what's Harvest Plus now is involved in trying to scale up all over the world. And we know Harvest Plus staff is small. And so we know that our job is to mainstream, get other institutions to mainstream the use of biofortified crops in their activities. So one of our main things is to get seed companies, private seed companies, to develop and market their own biofortified varieties. You have hybrid varieties of pearl millet in India. We're finding it's the small and medium-sized companies that want to take this on first. They want to increase their market share. The big companies are already comfortable. They don't like to try new things until they tell that it's caught on. So we have the same thing in Zambia with the 3 private seed companies. They're hybrid varieties of maize. 5% of commercial seed production in Zambia this year is going to be the orange maize seed. And the government has already included the orange maize they sell subsidized seed to farmers. So they've included now the orange maize seed in their subsidy program. So it's an even playing field between the white and the orange maize. We need international financial institutions to support the scale up. The World Bank is now riding the scale-up of biofortified crops in their grants and their loans to countries in Africa. We know about the grant for Uganda has been signed. They're working on a grant for Mozambique. There are a couple of things going with DR Congo. IFAD is doing the same thing with their loans. We need to get multilateral agencies involved. We've got the Purchase for Progress, World Food Program, buying now the high iron bean in Rwanda. They're buying locally, storing in their warehouses. By buying the biofortified beans and storing those in their warehouses, they add a nutrition dimension to an already, you know, well-functioning program. So that's what I tell all the agencies. If you just take, you're working on a food staple and whatever program it is, you substitute a biofortified crop, you've added a nutrition dimension to whatever your program is. We have a process now going in CODEX. They've voted now on new work for biofortification. They're developing a definition and standards now for biofortified crops, and that's going to facilitate the international trade in biofortified crops. I've mentioned already these governments are now investing. They have their own independent biofortification programs. We want their large scientific establishments, scientists to contribute to the scientific knowledge and the spread of biofortified crops. In Africa, the African Union has endorsed biofortified crops. I was a little bit the Commissioner for Agriculture and the Rural Economy spoke at the Fortification Summit, at the end of the Fortification Summit in Tanzania. And she had, of course, endorsed fortification, but she said, I think we need more biofortification than we need fortification, because we like our foods fresh and to have these minerals and vitamins in our, you know, in our fresh foods. So it was a little bit embarrassing, but I was, of course, glad to hear it. And finally, I want to mention that we want international NGOs to be involved in mainstreaming. So we've had a partnership now with World Vision for 3 years. World Vision works in 90 countries. They want to work biofortified crops into their agricultural programs as a way of linking agriculture and their health programs. And we've just secured our first grant from the Canadian government to work with World Vision in four different countries to introduce biofortified crops there. So I've gone over time, but anyway, thank you. I'm happy to answer questions.